Today at Reader's Corner, we welcome Barbara Demick, Beijing Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times and author of Eat the Buddha, Life and Death in a Tibetan Town. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Eat the Buddha is a gripping portrait of Tibet, spanning decades of Tibetan and Chinese modern history and told through the lives of its people. As she did with North Korea, award-winning journalist Barbara Demick explores one of the most hidden corners of the world, telling the story of a Tibetan town perched 11,000 feet above sea level, illuminating a culture that has long been romanticized by Westerners as deeply spiritual and peaceful. Demick reveals what it is really like to be a Tibetan in the 21st century, trying to preserve one's culture, faith, and language against the depredations of an all-seeing superpower. Eat the Buddha was named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, the Washington Post, NPR, and The Economist. Barbara Demick is the Beijing Bureau Chief of the Los Angeles Times. Her reporting on North Korea and coverage of Sarajevo have won numerous awards, including being a Pulitzer Prize finalist for international reporting. Her previous book is Lagavina Street, Life and Death in a Sarajevo Neighborhood. Barbara Demick, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
Well, let's start with this portrait of Tibet that you paint. You did it with North Korea, too. You do it specifically through the lives of the people who are living it. Maybe you can give us a word or two on how you came to settle on this particular approach. You could have taken a very historical or political analyst approach, but you're doing this through the lives of real people you've met.
That's right. I had really wanted to write something about Tibet that was accessible to readers who were not necessarily China hands or experts in foreign policy. And when I found when I talked to people and said, I'm writing about Tibet, they seemed kind of like embarrassed because they thought they should know more, but they didn't. And it was like a Dalai Lama, right? And so I wanted to make it a bit easier for them. And Tibet is a very complicated story geopolitically, but the lives of people are the lives of it's real lives. And I've always liked to read myself books that were stories, but that let you inside a place. I love, one of my favorite China books is Wild Swans. And I try to do the same thing with North Korea, you know, try to show what it was like to be them and build empathy for those people. So that was my basic approach.
Well, I suppose I'm one of those that was embarrassed when I picked up your book and saw the title and I saw the subtitle, Life and Death in a Tibetan Town. I was like, oh, I don't know much about this. And so I can appreciate what you're saying about those who do the same when they pick up the book. Maybe we should start with just a brief geography lesson. If you're going to go to Tibet, I mean, you as the person who actually visited Nagabo, Tibet, how are you going to get there? And then tell us a little bit about what you're going to see.
Sure. You know, Tibet is this, you know, huge, the Tibetan Plateau is this huge geographic feature that, of course, you can see from space. And it goes, you know, really from northern India to northern Burma, Bhutan, and really into the center of China. And a part of it is designated by the Chinese government, the Tibet Autonomous Region, but it's really vast. So for me, I was based in Beijing. I was the bureau chief for the LA Times there. And I would fly to Chengdu, which is the capital of Sichuan province. And China travelers might know it as the place you go to look at pandas. And then you drive sort of north and west through the mountains and through this, you know, very almost semi-tropical, very wet landscape. And then suddenly the sky opens up and the mountains fall away and you have this like vast grasslands in front of you. And every time I've gone to the Tibetan areas, it's just been like stepping through the wardrobe and the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and you're in this kind of magical world. It's a very distinctive, high altitude place. Not that many people can live there, with a very unique history and culture.
So perhaps you could help us with Nagabo. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, there's lots of different pronunciations. I'm saying Naba. A lot of Tibetans say Nawa, Chinese say Abba. Well, why don't we stick with Naba? But there's, depending on which dialect you're using.
Okay. So how did you manage to choose this particular city as your laboratory, you might say?
Well, I've always liked to work with microcosms. You know, if you pick a small place, it's easier to get a grip on it. I had my North Korea book was about one North Korean city, sort of an obscure place. My Sarajevo book was about one street. So I was looking for a town to profile, a Tibetan town, and this one really stood out. It had become kind of famous or infamous starting in 2009 when there were a series of self-immolations. Actually, there have been about 150 to date, but these young people, young Tibetans, were lighting themselves on fire, killing themselves in protests against Chinese rule. And that made it a very actually difficult place to visit. The Chinese government doesn't like journalists mucking around in places that embarrass them. And it was really difficult to go there. And, you know, one of the things about journalists, this is maybe why people don't like us, is that if you tell us not to go someplace, we want to go.
Exactly.
I was like, you know, we're a little bit like cats with a string, you know, pull it away and we're like, okay, we're obsessed. But I was like, what is it that the Chinese government doesn't want us to see? But, you know, it wasn't, some people have described my book as a book about self-immolations, and it's not really, it's, it happens in there, but this little town had a fascinating history. It was part of its own kingdom until the 1950s. I met a princess who was the daughter of the last king. It was also one of the first places where Tibetans encountered the Chinese Communist Party. This was during the 1930s, before the founding of modern China. And a lot of things happened there that sort of set the stage for, you know, decades of poor relations. Naba, I should mention, is sort of at the eastern edge of the Tibetan plateau. So it's like literally where Tibetan culture and modern China collide. And these collision points historically are always, you know, borderlands are always very tense and very interesting. So, you know, I had to pick a town, so I picked this one.
So I'd like to know more about what it's like to be a Tibetan with this bureaucracy of modern China breathing down your throat, not to mention its army. You tell the story of Ganpo. And again, I'm sure there's a better pronunciation for that you can give us. But it's the story of somebody who, a Tibetan, who is in a sense co-opted by the Chinese government. And they do this purposely, I suppose, to rob them of their culture. And maybe we can just talk generally about where the Tibetan culture is most challenged. You can mention Ganpo if that works.
Yeah. Ganpo is a central figure in the book. She's the princess who I mentioned. And the book opens in 1958 when the Red Army comes in and basically evicts her and her father, the king, and the rest of the family from Tibet and takes them away. And 1958 is really the year that it all started. 1949 is the founding of modern China and the victory of Mao Zedong over the nationalists. But 58 is when they really moved in to this part of Tibet. And this led to the flight of the Dalai Lama from Tibet in 1959. But Ganpo, the princess, when she was evicted, she was sort of at least initially embraced by the Chinese Communist Party. They didn't want to co-opt the Tibetan elite. And she had a very Chinese education, read the Little Red Book like other Chinese, learned to speak fluent Chinese, and actually married a Chinese man and became a school teacher teaching in Chinese. And so she was very conflicted between modern China and Tibetan culture. And this is actually one of the themes of my book. Tibetan Buddhism really stresses, you know, equality among people, the abrogation of the self, the transience of the sort of human vanity. And in a way, Tibetan Buddhism and socialism, I'm not talking about communism, but I'm talking about socialism, you know, the most idealistic view of socialism, have something in common. So there were many Tibetans who were, especially Tibetan intellectuals, who were sort of sympathetic in the early years to the Chinese Communist Party. It was like, oh, they're going to, you know, make us all equal and help the poor and this and that. And I still see that that strain in Tibet. In fact, the Dalai Lama, who I interviewed for this book, he's actually from the same, roughly the same part of Tibet, you know, said that he considered himself a socialist. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek because he's not really, and he's certainly very anti-communist, but you know, there is some sympathy between the Tibetans and, you know, sort of socialist ideals.
You're listening to Barbara Demick. She's the author of Eat the Buddha, Life and Death in a Tibetan Town. Well, one of the key components of any culture is its language. And I believe somewhere in your book, you mentioned that in some parts of Tibet, like maybe in an airport when you're trying to figure out what to eat, you can't even find the Tibetan language. You'll see it in Chinese, in Mandarin, but not in their native language. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the Chinese government has been steadily sort of nibbling away at Tibetan culture and the Tibetan language. And, you know, the Tibetan language, this is not some like obscure tribal language. I mean, there are millions of books in Tibetan, a lot of the earliest texts about Buddhism that came into China were in the Tibetan language. There's just a vast literature of medicine and astronomy and epic poems. And it's a very rich language and part of a very rich civilization. And at various times, the Chinese government has like banned the study of Tibetan, or they'll close Tibetan language schools, they'll close monasteries, which is where kids usually learn reading and writing in Tibetan, or they'll take another approach where is they'll say, okay, you can learn Tibetan, but there's nothing in Tibetan. And that's what I've seen in many Tibetan towns, that there's very little signage in Tibetan. If you watch, this was true in Lhasa, which I visited a few years ago. If you turn on the TV, the Chinese language news has like some, you know, snazzy looking young female presenter, and there's like a gray old man on the Tibetan. You know, there's just everything is done to discourage young people, especially from learning Tibetan. And it varies a lot from place to place, but it's been the Tibetan language has been a big issue.
Barbara, we've probably gone way too far in this interview without my asking you what Eat the Buddha means. I must say that even I was thrown off. I probably bought your book more for the subtitle than the title because I thought, my gosh, that even sounds sacrilegious. But it has a very interesting historical explanation. Why don't you tell our listeners about that?
That's right. Actually, I was just getting up to that. I think I mentioned that this area, Naba, was the first place that Tibetans encountered the Chinese Communist Party. And this happened in the 1930s during what's known as the Long March. And this is when the early communists fighting the nationalists, they were losing and they retreated trying to escape. It was the Long March was actually their flight from their enemies. And they went westward and northward and they ended up in the Tibetan plateau. And as I mentioned earlier, Tibet looks nothing at all like China. And they were like astounded. They were like, where are we? And they had, sort of no local knowledge, no language, and they had no food. So they started looting Tibetan homes and monasteries, and they ate these small statues made of barley flour and butter. And they felt like the Chinese actually wrote some memoirs about this, saying we were eating the Buddha and we knew it was a bad thing to do, but we were hungry. And that became kind of a symbol for the disrespect of Tibetan culture, that literally like the gobbling up this ancient civilization.
So you mentioned, I believe you mentioned earlier, the exiles or the folks who have either gone into China or wherever they might go. And one of the places they land is in India, Dharamshala, or again, we'll allow you to pronounce it correctly. But I wonder if you could Tell us a little bit about that. And again, through maybe through the eyes or through the life of Ganpo, who struggled to straddle this China-Tibet divide that fractured her family for years and years. As I understand it from reading your book, in the mid-90s, there were like, 118,000 people in Tibet, that today is around 74,000. Where are they all going? Are they all going to India? Or are they being assimilated into the rest of China? Please explain.
Yeah, well, as I said, I'm just going to backtrack a little bit because we were talking about the conflict among Tibetans. And many Tibetans have told me that they're grateful for the improvement in the economy under Chinese communist rule. Tibetans are still, for the most part, much, much, much poorer than Han Chinese. But they're not, for the most part, not as poor as they used to be. But what they regret is, you know, the loss of their culture. And one of the people I interview in the book, it makes it to the title of the last chapter, is Everything But My Freedom, is a pretty prosperous Tibetan businessman with a couple of cars and a couple of condos who said, I have everything I want in life, but my freedom. They can't learn their own language. They're not free to practice their religion, which is, of course, their culture, as they would like, and they're not free to travel. This is one of the big issues, is it's very difficult for Tibetans to get passports. So, you know, nowadays, okay, we're in a pandemic, but, you know, normally you see Chinese travelers all over the world. They're in Venice, they're in Paris, they're in New York, where I live. And Tibetans also want to travel, but they can't because they don't have passports. So they'll often sort of escape across the border into India, and that is where the Dalai Lama lives, and there's a large exile community there, and there are Tibetan schools, and some run by the Tibetan exile government, some run by NGOs. You know, they can be Tibetan there. They can learn their own language. They can learn their own culture, and this has been an issue for many of the people in the book. It's not just Ganpo, who is, you know, born a princess. There's a woman in there who I'm very close to, who was just, she was actually kind of a child bride and worked in the market. She's not a political person. She's not a famous person, you know, and she didn't suffer that much in Tibet. She was just poor, but she wanted her culture and her language, and she wanted to be Tibetan. And it's very difficult in parts of Tibet. You can't display the photo of the Dalai Lama. You can be arrested for something, you know, very, very minor. And, you know, we talk about the difficulty for Chinese journalists and for Chinese in Hong Kong and the lack of freedom in China. But for Tibetans, everything is worse. So they just have much less leeway to express themselves.
You mentioned the Dalai Lama more than once in our conversation here. Let's talk about his mortality. At one point in your book, you say that the Dalai Lama's mortality hangs heavy over Tibetans. He's now 90, around 90 years old, I guess. And the issue is one of succession. How's it going to work? Or do we have any way of knowing how it's going to work?
Well, traditionally in Tibetan culture, each Dalai Lama is thought to be the reincarnation of his predecessor. It's always been a he so far. And they have, you know, traditional methods of identifying a little boy who's born after the death of the previous Dalai Lama and raising him to be the new Dalai Lama. And it's not, frankly, for all the problems with American democracy, this is not really a great method of succession, but that's right. The way it works. And it's often caused a lot of tumult. But the Chinese have said, well, no, we're going to decide who's the next Dalai Lama. And they obviously want to pick a child from a compliant family who will do exactly what they say. So what many of us see happening is when this Dalai Lama dies, he's in his mid-80s now, there will probably be two Dalai Lamas. There will be, you know, a boy picked by the Tibetans and a boy picked by the Chinese. And that's just likely to cause a lot of strife. And, you know, something about this Dalai Lama is he has been such a vocal advocate of nonviolence. And, you know, he's the one who really propagated this thinking about nonviolence. The Tibetan, if you look at Tibetan history, there's plenty of violence, plenty of cruelty. Even though they're Buddhists, you know, there's war. But he was really a strong advocate of nonviolence. And these self-immolations in Naba have been very tied into that. Tibetans have said, you know, well, we're protesting against Chinese rule, but we're not killing or attacking ordinary Chinese. You know, we're not blaming them. We're actually burning ourselves rather than hurting other people. So after the Dalai Lama goes, it's unlikely that it will stay as peaceful as it's been.
I'm Bob Custer here at Reader's Corner. I'm interviewing Barbara Demick about her book, Eat the Buddha, Life and Death in a Tibetan Town. While we're on the Dalai Lama, I was fascinated by your discussion of the monastery and the key role it plays in the religious, the cultural, even the political life of Tibetan communities, right down to parents actually encouraging at least one son to go to the monastery. Perhaps you could explain how that works.
Sure. And another one of my main people, I'm not saying characters because they're real, is a boy who we meet also when he's 7 years old.
Yes.
And he's like a little Tibetan boy who actually doesn't know how to ride a horse. Mm-hmm. So his mother says, maybe I better make him a monk. But typically, a family will designate, especially if they have multiple sons, will designate one to be a monk because that's where you get an education. And for the most part, the Chinese government-run schools are pretty poor. Most, but not all, now only teach in Chinese. And parents have complained to me that, you know, their kids come out after a few years and they can't even write their own names. So the better monastery schools are like private boarding schools, or at least they were. They had, you know, they taught math and science and the Tibetan language, sometimes also the Chinese language, sometimes also English. And so you would send one of your boys to the monastery and they'd get an education. And, you know, interestingly, a lot of people have asked me about this, is like, how can you force a little child to become a monk? But many of these people don't become monks. They get educated at the monastery school and then they leave when they're 18 and they go to work. Some of them go to university. It's not considered a disgrace to leave the monastery when you grow up, but you're educated. And, you know, many, many of the Tibetan intellectuals had monastery educations. And this has been a big issue because the Chinese government has cracked down on the monasteries over the years. They've said, you know, children can't be enrolled and they can't teach this and they can't teach that. And, you know, in order to be in the monastery, you have to sign an oath denouncing the Dalai Lama, which is really sacrilegious. Tibetans won't do that. You know, even if they're not that religious, they won't do that. And so it's been these crackdowns on the monasteries that has led to a lot of the discontent.
So how has American foreign policy or diplomatic relations in general helped or hurt the plight of Tibetans as far as Chinese rule is concerned? And we have a new administration coming in. Is there anything that can be done to adjust our policies toward China that will make any difference in the lives of Tibetans?
I'm not really very optimistic. Some of the Chinese dissidents, you know, really thought that Trump's hard line towards China was a good thing. But I think it's been with every administration, there's a lot of lip service towards Chinese human rights and towards Tibet, but nobody really does anything. And the Tibetans tend to misunderstand that. I mean, during the 50s and 60s, maybe into the early 70s, there was some CIA support for Tibetan liberation, but that was a very brief thing. And now it really is lip service. I think what U.S. governments can do and other governments is like meet with the Dalai Lama. You know, don't listen to China when they say, you know, you can't meet with him. You can't offend, you know, you'll offend us. You'll hurt our feelings. And often heads of state are afraid to meet with the Dalai Lama because they're afraid it will impair their trade with China. Just, you know, just ignore that. Say, you know, well, you know, we trade with China, but Dalai Lama is the spiritual leader of 6 million people and a Nobel laureate. So we're going to meet with him. And I think, you know, sort of disregarding some of China's whining about Tibet would be helpful.
I suppose my next question has been answered in a number of your previous answers, but maybe just to get it on the record, how Tibetan is Tibet today? Or maybe the question is how Chinese is Tibet today? How much of this cultural autonomy has been lost? And is it going to get worse or has it stabilized? Does China at some point recognize that this is a province, that the Tibet Autonomous Region deserves a degree of autonomy greater than the rest of its provinces or not?
Not. I'd say it has less autonomy. I mean, this autonomous is just a joke. And Lhasa, which is the Tibetan capital, is becoming increasingly Chinese. There's whole neighborhoods that are exclusively Chinese and, you know, fancy new apartments that are built for Chinese and industries that are entirely staffed by Chinese. A lot of the shops and restaurants are Chinese. And, you know, it becomes less Tibetan each year. No, I was to say that the only thing that really protects Tibet from being overrun is that the Chinese have a very difficult time in general dealing with the high altitudes. And there are many Chinese who will not live in Tibet because they just don't feel well, especially people who are raised in the East who are used to a low altitude. And that's maybe the only protection. But, you know, China is has a large population and people want, you know, I mean, I hate to use the discredited term Lebensraum, but, you know, room to live, room to spread out. And there's been for decades kind of go back to U.S. history, kind of a manifest destiny of people moving west, trying to make new lives for themselves.
You, in your book, you deal with a young woman named Pima. And one of the things about her life is that her marriage was arranged, which is not uncommon around the world in some cultures. How prevalent is that in Tibet? And does the Chinese government have any concern about that?
Well, her marriage was not only arranged, but her husband had another wife. And that is technically not sanctioned by the government, but it's been pretty common in Tibetan society, you know, less so in the modern age. But in the past, actually, it was Tibetan women who often had more than one husband. And one of the traditions was that brothers would share a wife. And it was kind of a practical arrangement because one brother would be like out doing trade, earning money, and the other one would be taking care of the land and the animals. And I think that tradition has died out some, but I met many people who came from families where there was polyandry. And I don't think in general, my sense is, although the Tibetans dress very prudishly, you know, with a lot of full cover, is that their attitudes towards sex and family are maybe even a little bit more open than Chinese.
I have time for one more question, and I'm going to ask you about the man in whose memory you dedicated your book and why he is such a great loss to Tibetan culture. I mean, you've taken us inside the lives and the homes of these Tibetans in such a way, and so many of them, I assume, you were able to do that because you had some direction anyway. And he must have been it.
Yes, he was. This is a very sad story, but he was one of the first people from Naba who I met. And he was, we just knew him as Trutzik, which was his nickname, his longer name. But he was in his early 30s, and he was a writer and translator, historian, and, you know, a wonderful figure. He was actually the head of the exile chapter of PEN, the writers group, among Tibetans. And he was, you know, helping to introduce me to other Tibetans from this town. And he was just, he was really full of enthusiasm for my project and for making the Tibetan language better known, you know, getting more exposure for Tibetan literature that was not about religion, that was not about the struggle with China, just, you know, really elevating the civilization. And he was killed in a very stupid knife fight with actually a monk. It's a bit of a long story, but it was great. It was a great loss. And so I have dedicated my book to him.
Well, again, I don't mean to end on a sad note, but I did want you to have an opportunity to tell that story. Again, the name of it is Eat the Buddha, Life and Death in a Tibetan Town by Barbara Demick. Barbara, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much. I'd love to talk.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that shape our world at Reader's Corner.